Hello, and welcome to the February IASB Update Podcast. My name is Neely Shah, and I'm the Executive Technical Director at the IASB. Today, I'm joined by Andreas Barco, Chair of the IASB, and Sue Lloyd, Vice Chair. We've had another intense week of IASB meetings from the 21st to the 24th of February, and today we'll be sharing some highlights for you. We'll start with some big picture strategic topics and then move on to the technical projects. Andreas, can you kick us off with our discussion on some strategic matters, starting with the IASB's third agenda consultation?
Sure. The agenda consultation is a process the IASB undertakes every 5 years to set its priorities for the next 5 years. So in this case, from 2022 to 2026. In February, the IASB's big decision relates to the strategic direction and balance of its activities. The IASB, as you would expect, spends most of its time on standard setting, but it does much more than that, including supporting consistent application of IFRS accounting standards, supporting the digital consumption of financial reports, and stakeholder engagement, amongst others. Consistent with stakeholder feedback, the IASB decided that the balance of its activities is about right and to leave it largely unchanged, with a few small tweaks to slightly increase our focus on digital financial reporting, which becomes part of main standard setting anyway, and slightly increase our focus on understandability and accessibility of IFRS accounting standards, which will indirectly support the maintenance and consistent application of IFRS accounting standards. The IASB made these decisions about our work after considering the implication of connectivity and coordination with the newly created International Sustainability Standards Board, recommendations to partner further with national standard setters in conducting our work, and follow-on projects that may arise from post-implementation reviews of our accounting standards.
Thanks, Andreas. The other big piece of the agenda consultation involves a deeper look at the IASB's main activity, as you mentioned, standard setting. In March and April, the IASB will make decisions about which new technical projects to start in the period 2022 to 2026. However, to set the stage for those decisions, in February, the IASB also made a few decisions about its current work plan. Could you tell us more, Andreas?
Absolutely, and you're right. The board decided not to reassess the priority of projects on its current work plan and rather continue to progress those projects, with the exception of a narrow scope project on IAS 19 related to the availability of a refund of a surplus in a defined benefit plan. So very specific issue. The IASB decided to stop this project based on the limited progress and complexity of the project and an assessment of the expected costs and benefits.
Continuing with strategic matters, Sue, let's talk about post-implementation reviews. In February, the IASB concluded its decision-making on the PIRs of IFRS 10, 11, and 12 on consolidated financial statements, joint arrangements, and related disclosures. These were difficult decisions, in part because in the IASB's 20-year history, this is only the fourth PIR that it has conducted. So it's really been an evolution and a learning opportunity to enable a smoother process for the numerous PIRs we have in the coming years. Sue, before we get into the IASB's technical discussions on the PIRs of IFRS 10, 11, and 12, can you tell us a little bit more about what we've learned just generally about PIRs?
Okay, so first, some might think that they have to wait for a PIR before they can start to ask us questions about new accounting standards. And that's just not true. Some will know that for some of our new accounting standards, we've actually set up dedicated transition resource groups that are used to answer questions that arise during the implementation of new accounting standards before they become effective to really assist our stakeholders on a timely basis. We also monitor implementation and provide support through educational materials if we become aware of problems. And if necessary, as we saw with IFRS 17, the insurance contracts standard recently, we will do narrow scope standard setting if the benefits outweigh the cost, even before the effective date of the standard. And last but certainly not least, the IFRS Interpretations Committee stands ready to consider application questions at any time. And indeed, the committee's already answered many questions about standards before the PIR. We've answered a number of questions on IFRS 15, the revenue standard, IFRS 16, the leases standard, IFRS 9, and indeed this month we're going to talk about IFRS 17. So you don't need to wait for a PIR. I think the second thing we've learned about PIRs is we need to do a better job communicating about the objective of a post-implementation review. So we use PIRs to assess whether a new accounting standard has overall operated as the board intended, taking into account any new information about the application of an accounting standard that is different from what the board expected when they were developing the standard. But even if the standard is operating overall as intended, we still may be made aware of detailed matters that the IASB or the Interpretations Committee could address. So it's not as though an overall sort of tick for good performance means that we won't do something. But we do need to be realistic. We can't address all matters that arise. We need to be careful to assess the priority of the matters that we are made aware of, and we need to be consistent in how we approach prioritisation. So in January, we agreed on a consistent prioritisation approach to make those decisions. As a consequence of all of that, the outcome of a PIR can lead to a whole range of actions from the board. It can result in a major research project, like we've seen with the current project on goodwill and impairment, which came from the PIR of the business combination standard, IFRS 3. It could be a narrow scope project, like the project on the definition of a business that we completed a few years ago, which also arose from the PIR of IFRS 3. Sometimes we might do educational materials, and sometimes we might conclude that no further work is needed. So there's a real spectrum of outcomes, and it depends on what we hear, it depends on what the board's other priorities are, and it depends also on the feedback we get from about priority from our stakeholders.
Thanks, Sue. That's really helpful background. So with that then, what did the VISB decide with respect to the PIRs of IFRS 10, 11 and 12?
So we asked the staff to do some feedback and research for us several times, poor staff, and they identified some topics for us to potentially follow up and came with a series of recommendations. And that was on a range of topics, including investment entities, collaborative arrangements outside the scope of IFRS 11, transactions involving so-called corporate wrappers, transactions that change the relationship between things like associates and subsidiaries, disclosures about these types of investments, and also a range of application questions. And after talking about it a lot, the board decided that the topics identified in this PIR were not of high enough priority to be added to the IASB's work plan of active projects or research pipeline for 2022 to 2026. And that really reflects a pretty disciplined approach from the board on prioritisation. But the ISB did note that we do still, of course, want to help if it's needed. So if stakeholders need some more immediate support on application questions, they can still, of course, submit questions to the Interpretations Committee. So the ISB decided that after that discussion, we've done sufficient work to complete the post-implementation review of these standards. And so the staff will now prepare the report and feedback statement on the PIR, which is expected to be published in the second quarter this year.
Thanks, Sue. So we've covered our strategic topics, the agenda consultation and post-implementation reviews. Let's move on to a discussion of the technical topics that were discussed at the board. We'll first start by talking about our late-stage projects. These are projects that have had exposure drafts published over the last couple of years, and the board's in the stage of re-deliberating the feedback on those exposure drafts. And then we'll move into all things financial instruments, and we'll conclude with the IFRS for SMEs project. So Andreas, if you could start with our first late-stage project, primary financial statements. This project has consistently been at the board table for the last few months. Could you tell us what February's topics were about?
Sure. As we've mentioned in these podcasts before, the Primary Financial Statements Project seeks how information is communicated in the financial statements and with a particular focus on performance reporting. One important way to do this is through improved disaggregation. This month, the board looked at the required line items to be presented in the primary financial statements. The challenge here was about balancing the disaggregation principles, which help entities identify material information, with the higher level role of the primary financial statements, which is to provide an understandable overview. And a principle for line items to be presented in the primary financial statements with line items that we already require today. Some of the decisions the board made include requiring all presentation requirements to apply only when the resulting presentation does not detract from the primary financial statements, providing an understandable overview, and not revisiting requirements for required line items brought forward from IAS 1. There's one exception, and that is that we confirmed the exposure draft proposal to require goodwill to be presented separately in the statement of financial position. And lastly, the board decided not specifying any required line items in the financing category of statement of profit or loss.
Thanks, Andreas. The next later stage project is on rate regulated activities. This project seeks to provide useful information about the effects of differences in timing, that is regulatory assets and liabilities, on an entity's financial statements. These differences in timing arise when the rate charged to customers in a period include compensation for goods or services supplied in a different period. This is something you often see with utility companies, so water, gas, and electric companies, where rate regulation can significantly affect not only the amount, but also the timing of a company's revenue. Sue, could you give us some highlights of the deliberations in February?
Sure. So the meeting focused on the scope of the proposed requirements from the exposure draft that we published last year. So firstly, the ISB discussed whether adding the notion of a regulator within the scope of the standard could help decrease stakeholders' concerns relating to its application. So at the meeting, the board decided to include the notion of a regulator in the scope and to define what a regulator means. Secondly, the board reconfirmed proposals from the exposure draft, in particular that the final standard would apply to all regulatory assets, regulatory liabilities, and regulatory agreements, and the proposed conditions for a regulatory asset or a regulatory liability to exist. And third, the ISB decided not to explicitly state which regulatory schemes are within the scope of the standard, but to clarify the effect of some features of regulatory agreements for determining whether that would be in the scope of the standard.
Thanks, Sue. So all about scope on rate-regulated activities. Let's move on to the disclosure initiative and the project Targeted Standards Level Review of Disclosures. This project is about improving disclosures generally, and the exposure draft had two objectives. First, to improve the ISB's approach to developing and drafting disclosure requirements so that companies applying them provide more useful information to investors. The exposure draft proposed companies comply with disclosure objectives and apply judgment to decide what to disclose, instead of applying disclosure requirements like a checklist. And the second objective of this project is to test this drafting approach to see if the disclosure requirements in IFRS 13 on fair value measurements and IFRS 19 on employee benefits could be improved. The comment period on this exposure draft just closed. Andreas, can you tell us more about what the ISB discussed at its February meeting?
Yep. We discussed feedback from fieldwork with preparers and outreach with users. We had extensive participation by 50 companies in the fieldwork for this project and meetings with around 80 users. We're grateful to everyone who took the time to provide us this input. It has been really helpful. Overall, most participants supported the ISB's proposals to work more closely with users to develop disclosure objectives. But beyond that, feedback was mixed about the move away from prescriptive requirements to the use of disclosure objectives. Some participants were very strongly in favour of the proposals, while some others very strongly are against the proposals. Those in favour said it would help them make better judgment about what information is material and help with the removal of unnecessary information. Conversely, those against were concerned about additional cost, the impact of the requirements on comparability and auditability of the resulting disclosures. They also questioned whether disclosures would actually improve. A proposed approach by some respondents suggested a minimum list of required items to satisfy specific disclosure objectives. We did not make any decisions, but the ISB will discuss feedback from comment letters on this exposure draft in the second quarter, so stay tuned.
Thanks, Andreas. So that covers all of our late-stage projects where the ISB is discussing feedback on exposure drafts. Let's move on to projects involving financial instruments. There was a pretty healthy discussion at the board table on our Financial Instruments with Characteristics of Equity project around stakeholder discretion. If you have been following this project, you're aware that FICE seeks to provide guidance on how the classification and measurement of financial instruments with characteristics of both liabilities and equities. Sue, could you tell us more about the discussion?
Sure. So this month, the board was discussing practice issues around classifying financial instruments as debt or equity when they've got contingent settlement provisions. And we're focusing on a very specific part of this, which is how a company should classify a financial instrument when the contractual obligation to pay cash is subject to a shareholder vote. So basically, whether or not a company should be considered to have the unconditional ability to avoid the obligation to pay cash if that decision rests in shareholders' hands, for example. So many of the ISB members acknowledge that classifying these instruments as financial liabilities or equity will require judgment no matter what we do, and you'll need to consider specific facts and circumstances. And we also agreed that we needed to be really careful with the use of language. You know, the legal right to vote is a right that a shareholder has, and that doesn't really change depending on what is being voted on. So finding a way to distinguish some voting situations from others is what we were focusing on. So, you know, the board members helpfully noted that it was going to be difficult for a single principle to be applied consistently to different financial instruments all around the world. But the board did tentatively decide to explore providing examples of potential factors for entities to consider when assessing whether a decision in the hands of shareholders should be treated as if it were the decision of an entity for the purposes of debt equity classification.
Thanks, Sue. So staying with financial instruments, let's move on to the ISB's project on dynamic risk management. The objective of the project is to explore whether the ISB can develop an accounting model that will enable investors to understand a company's dynamic risk management and to evaluate the effectiveness of that risk management. In February, the ISB discussed the third of three critical challenges identified during outreach to the viability and operability of the ISB's proposed core DRM model. Andreas, could you take us through the ISB's discussions?
With pleasure. The ISB's discussion relates to the mechanics of the DRM model, that is, whether to recognize amounts and where to recognize amounts relating to the model in the financial statements. The original proposal of the portfolio revaluation approach suggests that measuring the entire designated portfolio at fair value with changes recorded in profit or loss. Many stakeholders rejected that approach, so the ISB tried another model. Under the second approach, we currently call the core model on which our outreach was based, proposed recognition in other comprehensive income of changes in fair value of derivatives that align the asset profile with the target profile. However, while stakeholders agreed that the model better captured the economics of managing net interest income, they expressed significant concern about the mechanics of the model. And this is rooted in the following fact. In contrast to the 2014 approach, the ISB had tentatively decided to use the mechanics of cash flow hedge accounting, which means that the changes in fair value of the derivatives used would be recorded in other comprehensive income and released as and when the cash flows hedged materialize. Similar to traditional cash flow hedge accounting, this could, and in certain cases does, lead to significant volatility in equity, which did trouble stakeholders. In February, the staff presented two approaches that would mitigate that effect. The ISB agreed with the staff that the approaches would better reflect the outcome of an entity's risk management. However, they would come at the price of potentially violating some quite fundamental concepts in financial reporting, being the recognition of items that do not meet the definition of assets and liabilities. So, no decisions were made by the board, and this topic will be discussed further at a future meeting.
Thanks, Andreas. There are definitely some tricky issues ahead to discuss further. Finally, moving on to the IFRS for SMEs project, the ISB made a number of decisions to progress towards this exposure draft. Andreas, could you briefly give us some important points from the discussion?
Yes, the ISB covered several topics and we have several papers. I won't go into all of them, but just reflect on the key decisions and I will speak to the requirements that we have in IFRS 9, simplifications to IFRS 15 and IFRS 3 business combinations. So IFRS 9, we focused this time on the impairment provisions and the ISB decided to require the use of the expected credit loss model for all financial instruments measured at amortized cost. and apply the simplified model to those, except trade receivables and contract assets for which the incurred loss model would continue to apply. Secondly, with regards to IFRS 15 and simplifications made to that standard, the ISB decided simplification to various topics, including contract modification, significant financing, and incremental costs of obtaining a contract. Then lastly, on IFRS 3 business combinations, the ISB decided to align the definition of a business to the amended definition from 2018 in Big Gap without introducing the rebuttable presumption, therefore confirming its tentative decision at the December 2021 meeting.
Thanks, Andreas. Before we conclude, we have one final update related to a narrow scope project on a lease liability in a sale and lease back. In February, the ISB made decisions about transition and effective date, and now the ISB expects amendments to be published in the third quarter of 2022. As we wrap up this podcast, we want to give you a big thank you, Sue. Would you like to say a few words?
Oh, yes. My last podcast as the Vice Chair of the IASB. And I think I've been doing these podcasts since the very first one when we started them as a sort of experiment. So I've been here to the bitter end and I've enjoyed doing them. You know, I've enjoyed being an ISB board member and vice chair very much. It's been an honour and a pleasure most of the time. And I think today I was reflecting as I looked at the script, it's pretty fitting that this is my last podcast, because those of you who have listened to our podcasts over time will know that, you know, an attempt at humour at various points in time, I've pointed out that the only person who would ever be given dynamic risk management to talk about was me. And so today, with Andreas taking the mantle, it's fitting that that should be my swan song for the ISB podcast. So with that, farewell, but maybe I'll get invited back for a guest appearance in the spirit of connectivity at some point in time.
Very good.
I'm quite certain we will be hearing from you many, many more times in the future. Thank you, Sue. Thank you for all your contributions. It's been an absolute pleasure to work with you in this capacity, and I'm looking forward to working with you further in your new role. With that, we'll conclude our February podcast. You can catch up on previous episodes of this and the IFRS Interpretations Committee on our website, as well as on YouTube and Spotify. If you like this podcast, please do take some time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player. Remember to tune in next month.